Hello, welcome to Graphic Policy Radio. This is your host, Elana Levin, and this is a comics podcast. This is a comics podcast for people who believe in community care and that there is no queer pride without disability justice, because July does come right after June. I'm so excited to be back on the podcast, and I am sorry that it has been a bit of a wait for new episodes from me, but we have some really amazing guests lined up to join us real soon. The multi-award-winning team of Alex Ross and Steve Darnall will be joining me very soon to talk about their classic political graphic novel, Uncle Sam. And I'll also be joined soon after that with the return of Kieran Gillen. His new comics series with Casper Wingard, The Power Fantasy, is coming out right now. And joining me today is a guest I've been wanting to have on for a long time, and I'm so glad we finally get to have them on. We're making this a reality. Hazel Nulevant is a Portland-raised, Brooklyn-residing cartoonist. They're an artist and one of the co-editors of the brand new Becoming Who We Are, Real Stories About Growing Up Trans comics anthology. And their comics include If This Be Sin, Tender Hearted, Sugartown, and No Ivy League. They edited and published the anthologies Chainmail Bikini and Comics for Choice. And their comics have been honored with the Ignatz Award, Zurek Grant, and the Prism Comics Queer Press Award. They like to dance around, alone or with others, and just released a very, very essential guide on COVID that was distributed at a number of queer pride events that were just happening. And I was really glad to have that come across my radar, and I know that'll be one of the things we'll be talking about today, because we love comics that are educational and powerful. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I'm excited to talk about Becoming, and yeah, happy to talk about this COVID infozine that I released recently, which has been kind of a passion project of mine to try and get this information out there for free and do that through comics festivals.
Yeah, I was so excited when I saw it because it's information that I'm frequently trying to communicate with people, and it can be a lot to explain to people with links and with blabbing at them, and really the zine format, how easy it is to distribute, the clarity of the language, illustrations, and everything else just makes communicating about it so much easier.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I really hope that it is getting through to people. It certainly seems to be popular with the COVID cognoscenti who are, you know, already concerned about this stuff, as far as like, yeah, a way to share. Basically, there's like all of these interlinking things that you have to accept or be aware of in order to still be taking COVID seriously. So I feel if somebody just is missing one piece of this, like, oh, I'm good because I'm vaccinated, or if I personally get it, it's definitely not going to be that bad, or just like some other piece of it, or masks don't work, or yeah, you kind of have to like accept and understand all of these interlinking things, at least just to bring somebody to the page where I am, or where we are, I think, which is that the pandemic is ongoing and the political response is has become totally disconnected from the biological reality of how much it sucks. And yeah, there's a lot of resistance to, you know, internalizing that, which I understand because it's a huge bummer. But I guess the good thing about learning all this stuff, that's another thing, is people might think like, what's even the point of me learning what kind of damage COVID might do to my body or various things about how bad it is? That's just going to bum me out. But actually, if you learn all the things, then like you can learn really like effective mitigation strategies that will really reduce your chances of getting COVID. So yeah, thank you so much for providing me with my little COVID soapbox. And, you know, I've been trying to connect it through comics because like that's what I was doing before 2020. You know, that's kind of my I mean, that's my career. That's my peer group, yeah, et cetera. And comics events, like shows, are pretty high risk environments. Mm-hmm. I want to plug what the Cartoonist Co-op has been doing recently.
We love the Cartoonist Co-op here.
Yeah, yeah. Their website is cartoonist.coop. And yeah, they just released a whole statement on the importance of requiring masks at festivals in order to make them more available to everyone.
Yeah, I was just writing the other day how, you know, most people in comics are very underinsured. People have no sick days. And so the idea that people are forced into situations where they could easily catch COVID and where they could easily end up with long COVID and have no ability to work for extended periods of time really shows you that, like, any kind of economic realism for the industry requires taking COVID protection seriously for everyone in comics, not just for the so-called vulnerable, because everyone is vulnerable to long COVID. Like, everyone is vulnerable to it. Mm-hmm. And the more people getting sick, the more people are going to have long COVID and be additionally vulnerable. So I was really glad to see the Cartoonist Cooperative speak out about this workplace. I mean, it's what the co-op should be doing, is defending the ability of people in comics to work and survive and be healthy.
Yeah, it's really right on. And yeah, how just how much things can spiral downhill is what has made me take COVID so seriously. I thought, I really want to protect my ability to keep making my gay little comics. Like, that's the important thing to me. But on a positive note, as far as like community who's on that page, Cartoonist Co-op has a list of what different shows are doing as far as masking and COVID mitigations. But I am tabling at FlameCon in Manhattan on August 17th and 18th, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they do have a masks required policy. So, you know, love that. Really appreciate that. It'll make it a lot more chill to, you know, take a sip of water behind the table when I need to. And yeah, looking forward to it. Of course, we all know that you gotta be providing the masks and have people going around saying, "Hey, remember to put it on." So, you know, we'll see what masks required really means. I don't want to, you know,
You haven't been to FlameCon during the ongoing pandemic yet?
No, that is true. I haven't tabled since 2019, so I don't know what they did last year. But yeah, is it promising?
I was there last year to do a panel, and I was basically there for my panel, and then I left because the show floor was just too many people for me, regardless of the mask policy, you know? But my experience is that because FlameCon, at least at that point, was handing out masks, people by and large were wearing them. Now, not everybody knows how to wear a mask properly. For example, people forget that they need to flatten the nose wire and then put on their mask and then bend the nose wire around the shape of their nose, because masks, especially ones that come folded in the middle, the nose wire is not by default shaped to follow the shape of your nose. Your nose isn't a triangle. Your nose bridge is usually curved rather than a sharp triangle. And the only way you're going to get that wire to actually follow the contours of your face is to flatten it first and then put on your mask and then push down the sides of the nose wire around your nose. Actually made a video demonstrating this. And then people also have to check their masks to make sure they're fitting without leaks. Anyway, with FlameCon, because they want to get people to actually wear the masks that they're handing out, the masks are rainbow, and it is very hard to find filtering respirators like a KN94 style mask that is rainbow, despite the fact that they would literally be saving millions of lives if somebody manufactured this. So, you know, it means that the majority of people present are wearing, you know, surgical masks, and they're very thin ones. But cumulatively, you know, having a bajillion people wearing surgical masks is so much better than not having people masking, even if it's not, you know, like the ideal that I would set up. It really does make a big difference, especially in scale. And, you know, again, not everybody is actually following it properly even, but generally speaking, it seemed like most people were wearing their mask most of the time, but that most of the masks were not, were the ones that were the ones FlameCon was handing out, or some people were still wearing fabric masks that were decorative kind of. So it's better than any other conference that I've seen. And I'm really grateful that they are doing that. It's not what I would do if I was God of the world, you know, but like it's meaningful. And additionally, you know, the space they're holding it in for the rooms and stuff like that is, you know, everything's got upgraded MERV 13 air filtration. And when I was there last year, there was a HEPA machine on top of it all in the room I was in, although I don't know if that is true for all the rooms. So I would say, you know, it's way better than any other con I've heard of.
Wow. I love to hear that. In other words, mitigations are mid.
Mitigations are mid and they exist. And I also feel like the general community vibe is like people are trying. And so having your zine, which gives people some really good educational materials in hand to share with people in that space, I think it's just a perfect audience for folks to receive it. Because like you were saying, that people have to be willing to accept a number of realities in order to be willing to learn more. I really think that the people who are at FlameCon are the people who are ready to learn more, you know? So,
well, that's nice to hear. And I will have a box of them at my table to hand out for free. I've been taking them to shows since this spring, and it makes me feel good because even if it's a really slow show, I feel like I have a purpose to be sitting there. But people should also come by so that they can purchase copies of Becoming Who We Are, the new anthology. This is why I was making sure to table at FlameCon, because Becoming Who We Are, the subtitle is True Stories About Growing Up Trans. So it's aimed for middle grade readers, and it's all based on interviews with trans people from different really cool walks of life, and all illustrated by different trans artists. So yeah, I thought obviously FlameCon would be the perfect place to be selling that and represent. And I was honestly pleasantly surprised that I'm not just gonna have to be wearing my elastomeric respirator and white knuckling it. I still will, but the knuckles are going to be less white.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, did I take off my mask to have a drink of water at any point in time? No. However, I did leave feeling pretty confident that I had not contracted COVID. And that's a start. So I actually recently, like, literally rented a machine to do fit testing. So I feel.
Cool. A port account.
I did. And I'm hoping that we can organize more people to do community events so that everybody has the opportunity to come with a mask and see if it fits their face, because we all have very different faces.
That would be so cool. I think Zine Fest should be doing this. I heard the masking at the Black Zine Fest was really good. I didn't make it to that, but looked amazing from the pictures. So yeah, I'm interested, I guess, in mobilizing the infrastructure of comics and Zine Fest, just because that's where I have a whole leg in the door to, you know, use that to set norms around masking. But yeah, we could have a port account somewhere and have it be outside, or yeah, another thing that you can do is you can take a nebulizer and then you can make a fluid by like boiling
saccharin and water
low packets. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you're like tasting for the leak. So I'm actually going to do that soon.
Oh, it's totally good to do that. Yeah, I'll include some links to this in the show notes here. Because I know people who mask everywhere and have gotten COVID anyway. And every time I look, I'm like, I don't think your mask fits your face right. I think so many of the people who I know who haven't had these problems are cis white men whose masks fit them properly because their faces are shaped like the criterion that everybody caters to in our society. And there's a bajillion different potential masks out there. And there is going to be one out there that either fits your face or can be altered to fit your face. I learned all about how to like adjust and fold and like do things like that to make things, to staple straps differently, to have everything so that it can be, so things can work for people who don't just have one kind of freaking face. Mm-hmm. And it really matters. So I hope people don't just give up because they've had a bad experience in the past.
Yeah, me too. I've learned so much since doing the zine also, which I was working on for about a month from like February to March, I think. But yeah, just by like the responses people had and then like continuing to be involved in anti-COVID action. So now I'm already full of like what the 2025 edition would have. And that's definitely a thing, is rather than like recommending a few masks as like the gold standard, to emphasize like how much the faces come in a wide variety of shapes, and like really just trying different ones on and feeling for leaks is the most important thing. And also like the stuff that people can do to upgrade their surgicals, like get a mask brace.
Even if your mask sucks, it's still better than inhaling a full lung full of COVID. Like, they do really think that you will get less sick if you are inhaling less COVID. So even an imperfect mask is better than not having one. Like, we know this. But yeah, so there's so much education work we can do. And I'm also happy to answer people's questions online. You know, when I posted about an event I was speaking at recently, saying I'll be there in my N95 and you'll be able to hear me just fine. You know, somebody said to me, well, when I'm wearing my mask, it always is getting caught in my mouth, so it's hard for me to speak clearly. And I said, then your mask is definitely not fitting you properly. Like, we need to get you a different mask. That shouldn't be happening. And I shared with them some more rigid options that they can try, for example, because I was like, we have to get you to something else. but, you know, yeah, I love FlameCon. It has always been... I say this every time I mention FlameCon. You know, I came out in like, I don't know, 1996 or something like that. So I've been in a lot of queer spaces in my life. And like, FlameCon is my happy space, like still, you know, beyond. I've been in them all and like, that's my place. And so I'm really happy to hear that they are making efforts to make it safe in that way for people, or make it safer and to mitigate things. And and, you know, I'll share, like, the two groups of that have the highest rates of long COVID are transgender people, 11% of whom have long COVID, and adults with disabilities, 12% of whom have long COVID. And so, and bi people are, like, right up there with transgender people. And queer people overall, like, including, like, cis binary queer people, also have unusually high rates of long COVID. So this is really an issue in our community, regardless of the fact that our community is more vaccinated than most. It is not a solved problem. And there's just so much education to do. And I speak about this because I care about people's future and health and our survival as a community. And I really appreciate like the sort of positive educational accessibility of the guide that you've made. I think that's really powerful and useful for people.
Thank you. Yeah, it certainly, having masks required and getting your ventilation up and all these things is what it takes to have an inclusive event nowadays, or it's one of the things that it takes. And yeah, the zine is called What's Up with COVID and How to Protect Yourself 2024 edition. It's definitely formatted in that way of like, here's how it transmits, here's the dangers, and here's what I know about protecting yourself, which is mostly don't breathe it in, masks and ventilation. Yeah, so it doesn't really get into when should you be using these mitigation strategies. You know, I think the more the better, but it is open-ended in that way, because I don't want to turn people off of like ever wearing a mask if mm-hmm. they think that, you know, I want people to like just be cognizant of what are the most high risk things. It's really just, it's all about how many people are in an enclosed space. Like, it's just mm-hmm. not as bad to have lunch with one person as it is to be in a crowded convention hall. So,
yep.
Yeah. I think that having that perspective of like, what's the chances that somebody here has COVID has been, has really helped me navigate.
And with the reality we have right now numerically based on wastewater data, we can guarantee that if you're in a group of people like at the conference, someone has COVID.
At the con, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like it's just true. You know, the thing that's interesting is what you're doing is in the legacy of ACT UP and all of these historically significant HIV queer organizations who were doing community education from within the community during a pandemic in which the federal government left people to die, kind of like this. And so as much as it like is painful to see certain places of the queer community go full on COVID denialism, I feel like there are also some of the best actors that I've seen in addressing it are people who come from the queer community and are looking at some of these models and being like, yeah, like queer people were the people who began doing educational work to destigmatize the use of condoms back in the 80s. We were on the forefront of that. Like, it's hard for young people to realize that like, condom use was like stigmatized before, but it was. So, you know, like, we have the ability to do education for people on how to protect themselves when the government won't, you know?
That is for sure. And they did some of that education through comics too. Yeah, there was a really incredible one that I found recently that was like some kind of like sexy fictional comic where the guys were both using condoms. And then, I forget the details, but I think maybe Senator Jesse Helms was like brought it up on the Senate floor and was like, this is why we cannot be giving funding to anything that does
educational.
I can't remember all the details.
You're trying to tell kids about condoms. And of course, like my parents were good.
Yeah.
People should tell kids about condoms. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I would certainly tell them about condoms.
I was certainly obsessed when I found out because my next graphic novel, it's going to be called Queer and How We Got Here, which is kind of a mouthful. But it's like using personal anecdotes to introduce various, like the histories of different queer topics, like have my own coming out story and then the history of coming out as a social practice, that kind of thing.
How cool.
Yeah, it's been so fun to research and gratifying. And yeah, I have read a fair amount about ACT UP for that. The stuff that they accomplished by just having really specific protest targets and demands and then doing like a really eye-catching protest that, you know, doing a die-in or whatever, it's just beyond. So I certainly have been trying to look at their playbook to think, you know, what anti-COVID action could look like. It's like about, I think, finding who has the decision-making power for a certain kind of policy change. Like for anti-COVID action, it could be like who has the power to require masks in state hospitals again, or to require upgrading ventilation, or to reopen testing sites, these kinds of things. And then just really protesting the shit out of them.
We actually have there's a new petition and campaign for getting funding to upgrade the air cleaning technology in private buildings. And then, you know, locally in New York, we are fighting off a state mask ban being pushed by our so-called Democratic governor and so-called Democratic mayor. And I think we stand an excellent chance of preventing the ban, but like people have to show up to fight it. You know,
it's really horrifying.
We shouldn't have to do this work.
Yeah, absolutely deranged.
The COVID Advocacy New York has the toolkit.
Yes, yes. Love them.
It's so covidadvocacyny.org. But, you know, what you're speaking to about, it sounds like doing nonfiction comics that are connecting personal narrative and history is a theme that I see through a lot of your work. Like, what is it about that combination of strategies and comics that really speaks to you?
Well, the fact that I am doing Queer and How We Got Here, and that it does build on my past work in such a clear way, that's kind of an outcome of the publishing industry. Like, I did a comic for The Nib about queer uprisings that happened before the Stonewall riots. And then,
yeah, that was such a good one.
Thank you. You know, really enjoyed doing that. And then my editor contacted me to say, can you pitch me a graphic novel that is queer history, but has some autobio elements? And I was like, yes, this is where my strengths and experiences lie. I thought, oh, maybe I'll really challenge myself by learning how to write fiction. But, you know, then hearing that there was this appetite from a publisher to do something that's so in my wheelhouse, you know, I wanted to do it. And then the book has like taken on so many different dimensions as I actually have researched each of these 12, I think, different historical threads. And I think at first I was more excited about presenting my own like transition narrative and like these other aspects. And now I think I'm more excited about it as a vehicle to share with people just some of the amazing stuff I've learned about like what organizations and what activists and who helped shape our reality that we're living in now, where it was relatively easy for me to be a tween and come out as bisexual and to go through all kinds of sexual and gender exploration, and now to live as a non-binary transmasculine person and get my hormones from it's covered by New York State health insurance. So yeah, unfortunately we can't project like a beautiful line of just rights and freedom ever increasing. It was a very sad day when I had to edit the part about Roe versus Wade being a victory of the feminist movement, because of course it's people on the ground who like form the environment in which the Supreme Court makes their decision. So sad day when I had to say this was a victory of the feminist movement in the 70s.
Yeah.
But yeah, as to like a broader, why do I do comics about myself and queer history, it's just the most fun for me. You know, I think I do comics about myself because, you know, I have this extra like burning motivation of self-expression, like that there's certain things about my life that I want people to understand, or like that I want to tell a certain story and be able to share it better than just telling it to have people feel like they're in the moment. And yeah, it just always kind of seemed like an obvious thing to pull from. And yeah, it just has this additional of motivation to it that I think other things would not, where I feel like I have to get this off my chest. And yeah, the history aspect, I don't know. That's just where all the cool shit comes from that is not stuff that I've experienced myself. That's how I learn about it. Kind of been on that train since art school, which was a long time ago now. I did a comic about Gladys Bentley, who was a cross-dressing blues singer, part of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah.
Sort of an original drag king. It's a bit different, but Gladys Bentley is definitely part of that lineage. So since then, I've done a lot of different comics that combine those elements. Or I guess with the anthologies, sometimes that, I mean, that's, I guess that's people's personal stories too, but those, like Comics for Choice and Now Becoming Who We Are, I work on those more in a capacity of like trying to get people who are totally outside the world of comics or who, you know, wouldn't be writing comics normally. In the case of Comics for Choice, it was like people who volunteer for abortion funds, like a provider, historians of reproductive rights, people who have used abortion funds to access that. And yeah, trying to pair up all these different folks with cartoonists who wanted to volunteer to illustrate somebody else's thing. And I think that's really powerful to then, you know, get that different, all these different like centers of knowledge and experience still then onto a comics page and onto a bookshelf. And it's distributed then through all the routes that comics are distributed. And Becoming Who We Are, similarly, my co-editor actually was the one who did all of the interviews with the different stars of the book. But, you know, it's people who wouldn't normally have written their own comic, like a science teacher, a scientist, a forest ranger, a firefighter, a musician.
Really liked the selection of careers that you showed, because I think for kids, like, sometimes there's everybody either is like doing the most like star powered thing ever, or people can just sort of see it as boring. And you're like, here's people doing interesting things that are not celebrities. And there's something accessible about like, you could be a forest ranger. Like, that's an interesting, meaningful career. And it's not like winning the lottery to have that career, you know? And the firefighter, like, it was an interesting array of career choices that I thought about it from the standpoint of like, these feel like interesting, achievable, relatable, but like interesting people, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah, that was all Sammy Lassell, who is a parent, and that's why she wanted to do this book, basically, was to give her kids these stories in comics form to be inspired by and feel like there's so many different hopeful possibilities for adulthood as a trans person. So it makes sense that it would appeal to parents, and that's certainly good because that's, you know, one of the steps to getting a book to a middle grade audience, you know. At first it has to go through like the booksellers and the librarians and the parents. But yeah, it's kind of in the mold of like a you can grow up to be anything you want to be and also trans kind of book.
Yeah. How did you decide your story is the one about a non-binary firefighter? And you have stuff from early in their life and their childhood. You're telling somebody's story from somebody's real life in the past. And, you know, are you like looking at reference photos, or are you going from a conversation with them? Like, how are you developing? How are you depicting that?
So for the comic that I illustrated, which is about Brooke Guinan, who was the first openly trans firefighter in the FDNY, I was really lucky because there's a whole documentary about her. She uses she and they pronouns. A whole documentary called Woman on Fire, which had a bunch of her childhood photos in it, and it had interviews with her parents and, you know, pictures of her parents when she was younger, when everybody was younger, I guess. So I worked from that for visual reference a lot. And yeah, it was definitely a relief to have that to go off of, because it's an important responsibility to be depicting somebody's life like that. And, you know, if the documentary didn't exist, I would have said, could you send me a bajillion photos, and probably asked her, like, I don't know, what was your mom's hairstyle when you were six? But yeah, I was much blessed in that.
I really liked how much of her personality and her sense of, like, humor, you know, you can really get through the story.
Yeah. Sammy also did a really good job with interviewing people about their lives and then thinking through, you know, how would this fit into a 16 pages or less comic that would connect with young readers. So, you know, of course, everybody is, like, such a brilliant and fascinating person that there's plenty to work from. But yeah, I really appreciated her labor too in turning these interviews into scripts. And then, of course, there was a lot of back and forth with the subjects as far as, you know, were they liking the script? Were they liking the thumbnails? All this. But yeah, I'm glad that is coming through in the final product, because, yeah, I don't know. I was just excited to get to know Brooke a bit through these different mediums. And, you know, I'm excited for readers to get to know all of these people.
You know, I mean, depicting anybody who's a real person in comics art can be very fraught. And depicting, you know, trans people, both in their present life and in people's lives when they were younger, it's just added level of complexity to being able to do that and have people see each other properly. And, you know, I'm sure there was, like, a lot of back and forth going there. It just reminds me of a conversation I had with comics writer Zoe Tunnell. Listeners will know her from our episode with Sarah Valentine about their comic together, which is Blade Maidens. Anyway, she was saying, you know, how much she loved getting art from her comics artist friends that were depictions of her. And I was like, you let other people draw you without micromanaging everything to a degree at which an artist would actually, like, not, like, lose their mind and yell at you and tell you to leave it alone. Like, what? This is completely alien notion to me. I cannot allow anybody to depict me. I have zero faith in anybody's ability to depict me how I would like to be seen. It was just completely, like, this is, like, what is this bizarre, completely unrelatable sorcery that I can't conceive of? And I know so many, like, trans people who, you know, getting art of themselves inhabiting their gender as they'd like it to be seen is so validating for people early in transition, or but I don't know, it just feels like very weighty to be doing that for somebody's biographical story.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to it. I was talking to my friend Molly Ostertag recently about, like, queer comics and, like, drawing queer characters in general. And she was saying that, like, there's something about the act of drawing where, and seeing a drawing where you can somehow, like, feel the love and admiration that the artist is putting into it. So yeah, it's hard to quantify, but yeah, I think on the one side, like, you can kind of feel when, like, somebody is drawn lovingly and admiringly. But on the other side, you know, these are real people. They're not drawing themselves. So it was, like, a step of, or So it moved away from them being so in control of it. And then that kind of played out in different ways for different stories. I really love the story about Dr. Kate Stone, which was drawn by Ravi Teixeira. And he approached the art, and I think this is how Kate, this is probably Kate's idea of how to approach it, but like drawing her as like looking like a little girl in her childhood, even though that wasn't how what the people around her were seeing.
Right.
And I think, yeah, that comic has like a really beautiful way of like holding that tension of like drawing the self perception, but then there's a couple tricks to it to show that is not what she looked like to the other people in her life at the time. Or, yeah. You know, there was another one, I won't say which, but it got feedback from the subject that they felt like their neck was drawn too thick. And so then that got edited.
Good.
But it's certainly easier when you're drawing yourself. I love comics by trans artists, trans creators, because what's not to love about that? But, you know, I think that's such a fun opportunity for shaping how people perceive you. And I love seeing what different people do with that. Like Phlox by Elle Nichols. They draw themselves as like a stuffy doll with button eyes. It's like constantly getting pierced through with different arrows. You can draw yourself in a more abstracted way. But yeah, I think that's kind of a nice like handshake meeting of autobio comics and trans self-representation, like the ability to draw an idealized form or, you know, an unidealized form. Like you could like do drawings that are like self-hating if you want to, but at least you're in control of that whole process.
I have seen so many trans women self cartoons be very unflattering depictions of themselves, and I'll see a photo of them and I'm like, you're so pretty, this is breaking my heart. Like I like especially like women doing comedy ones, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm like, I'm not gonna, I feel like I'm not supposed to say anything, but it's like that's not what you look like. And maybe that is what you looked like at one point, but that's not what you look like now. Mm-hmm. And that's, and I've actually struggled with that question before. I'm like, I know you think you're ugly, but you're wrong.
I mean, it's very, I guess, Aileen Kominsky crumb of them to draw in a way that highlights insecurities or that they would consider unflattering for comedy.
Yeah. That's so such a great example of an artist who did that. Yeah, you would totally look at her art and be like, wow, that's like this like really heinous person. It's like, no, she's an attractive person. Like, you know,
was
like a fashion model, but was, oh my God, that's, you know, like, yeah, yeah. And she continues to be such an influential, you know, comics creator for people doing autobiographical work, feminist work, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you're right. That does connect right back to that. But yeah, I just always wondered if it felt like it was people who were like expressing an ongoing kind of dysphoria that I was like, I want you to feel better.
Or like, yeah, a dysmorphia about
yes,
how they look.
About how they look now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's kind of the difficulty with all kinds of self-deprecating humor. I like to do self-aggrandizing humor more so
like
that then
people
can agree with it and then they're not dissing me than having to be like, no, you're wrong.
I like that self-aggrandizing humor. Well, you know, I read Sugartown like a billion years ago. I probably picked it up at FlameCon, although hard to say.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's definitely like, it feels like I recognize you and your art, you know, throughout all the different phases of your self-depictions and things like that. And there's like a character consistency and, you know, like how did you sort of develop how you wanted to present yourself on the page in that way?
Let's see. This is a little I like to show a bunch of different examples of how I've drawn myself over the years when I give talks. So also email me if you would like me to give a talk to your class or what have you for money. And I can,
yes,
you'll be seeing all the visualizations, but, yeah, I mean, basically, first I tried drawing myself as Brian Lee O'Malley would draw me. Like, I was like, can I draw myself looking like a Scott Pilgrim character? Although the kind of swoopy nose was always, or I was always doing like it, because he doesn't really do noses. It's very manga-esque. And then like,
yeah,
it's just like different drawing experiments over the years. And like in school, like for an assignment, drawing myself a bunch of different ways, I hit on this kind of this like swoop nose that you can see, like if you look at my social media icons or stuff like that. And then I otherwise had kind of like a manga-esque way, or like very influenced by Sophie Campbell as well. Big fan of her art. And yeah, then I drew myself looking like that in like a short story about homeschooling. And then that was how I was drawing myself in No Ivy League. And because I think of it all as like the canon, I'm like, you can get to know the Hazel of the books by getting all the books. There's a certain consistency to how I draw myself because I think of it as all like the canon of Hazel of the comics, and you know, it's all connected together. But I have had to reevaluate how to draw myself, which was also fun. Like when I started working on Queer and How We Got Here, you know, that has like present day me as a narrator. And so, you know, I played with it, like now my face shape is different, drawing myself with arm hair, stuff like that. Yeah, but that's how I settled on drawing myself. And but it's funny to be doing these self-representations, because I think I started working on Queer and How We Got Here in 2020, and I had like pink K-pop boy band hair that was short, and now I have like a long brown mullet. But you know, that's certainly not the only thing that's changed about my life since I started working on the book. But you know, it's very funny to be presenting it as this is me right now, but then I work on it for 5 years, and then the me of the book is, of course, an artistic product that's pinned in place on the pages and is somewhat left behind by my actual life experience. So, yeah, at a certain point, it's just got to be what it's going to be. You know, I can't keep updating it every minute to be reflecting how I'm changing.
Such an interesting like piece of like being a trans creator, for sure. So what brought you into comics as a medium in the first place?
I did a little like pre-college workshop at PNCA, Pacific Northwest College of Art, when I was a teen, and like just spent like a couple weeks, I think, learning about comics and drawing different comics. And yeah, that's when I was introduced to like Fun Home, Understanding Comics, Blankets, Mouse, Persepolis. Kind of got the American and French autobio comics starter pack. And yeah, that's really what did it, because before that I was more reading manga, and I didn't know that American comics were anything other than superheroes or Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, which I did enjoy, but you know, learning
came from that too, yeah.
Having this, I guess learning that the like slice of life or like day-to-day type of storytelling was not just in manga kind of flipped a switch for me. And yeah, before that, like growing up or in my teens too, I figured I'll be some kind of artist. I'm going to be a painter or something. But then I just really loved how comics are so creatively challenging. Like, it's just so many different levels with like the page layout and the lettering and the character design and the acting and the writing of a story and possibly the coloring. And background design certainly doesn't cover everything. But yeah, going from like, well, I can paint, I can do an acrylic painting of a photograph like pretty good, to having to challenge myself and juggle all of these different things. I just thought it was so cool. So basically since then, I knew that I wanted to work in comics somehow. So I like did a publishing internship, and then I ended up going to art school here in New York. And so yeah, it hasn't been too curvy of a trajectory. And I kind of thought that I wanted to do comics and went full force into that. So that's been very lucky. But it is hard to sustain as a career. And these days, I'm thinking I just want to do what it's going to take to like be able to work from home and feed my cats. And I feel very proud of what I've accomplished so far. But after I finish this next book, could be anything, you know, maybe I'll become a COVID safe home care aide, or maybe I'll become an HVAC technician to help upgrade everything to ASHRAE standard 241 for control of infectious aerosols. I'm sure that wouldn't be annoying at all. I'm sure I wouldn't have to.
No, one of my friends who's an artist, I mean, he was like, he's also like, I think if I had to do another career, I might do HVAC. So like, this is like the zeitgeist career for arts people who are COVID aware, apparently.
It's a vibe. But who knows? No promises, nothing off the table, but I hope people will buy a bunch of my comics at FlameCon. And I'm going to finish this book that I've been working on next year. It's going to be done. I'm going to turn in the art, and then it's coming out probably 2026. So look for that. And
who's the publisher for that going to be?
Oh, the publisher for that is Little Brown. I believe Little Brown Ink is the imprint now.
Sweet.
And yeah, I'll try and really support the publication of that, even if I'm an HVAC technician at that point.
So, you know, one piece that's sort of a bit different from what we've covered before is
what is this suddenly music?
I've never had that happen before. Apparently there is a button that I can hit on Zencastr where it'll begin playing dramatic piano for no reason.
Wow.
That's almost as exciting as the time we accidentally pressed the disco button in my friend's apartment.
What happens when you press the disco button?
Well, if you're, for example, pet sitting for your friend's cat and are trying to leave to go get dinner and lock up their apartment, you may accidentally press the disco button, at which point a disco ball, the lights will dim, a disco ball will descend from the ceiling, the projector will also descend, and disco will begin to play in their apartment while their cat just looks very like, this is just a thing that happens sometimes. And then you can spend the next hour trying to reach your friend who's in the woods to ask how to deactivate.
Maybe
the
I'll
disco
be a
button.
Disco button technician. I'll install disco buttons in people's houses.
Oh my God. It was like all coming from some like Apple smartphone. Not smartphone, Apple
that's
smart
too
home
much.
Setting.
That's I was too like, much.
Well, it was custom. I don't think that's a default setting in your Apple smartphones for making a disco. But but on a different note, Chainmail Bikini is pretty different from a lot of the other kinds of work you've done, if you want to talk about that for a minute.
Well, Chainmail Bikini, subtitled The Anthology of Women Gamers, is an anthology of comics that I put together and published on Kickstarter. Came out in 2015, I think. So it was a different era. If you guys remember the discourse of fake geek girls and then Gamergate, it was sort of responding to that. You know, at the time, it seemed like what we really need is, also a reason that I put it together is just I was really enjoying a lot of people were publishing really cool short comics that were about gaming in some kind of way, but also had like a personal angle and using gaming as a metaphor. There's like a couple different ones that I saw on Tumblr that, you know, made me think that this was a really fruitful opportunity for storytelling. Like, how are these fantasy settings integrating and interplaying with our real lives? And yeah, it was all by women cartoonists, quote unquote. You know, since then, a bunch of us have came out as different genders and
not
transitioned.
Surprised. Yeah.
And doing something that's all women seems very dated to me now. But it was the thing at the time. And I mean, it's similar to my other work in the respect that there are, you know, a lot of autobio stories. I did two pieces for it, and they were both little autobio things. One was about playing Diablo 2 with my friends, and the other one was about Vampire the Masquerade.
Ooh.
I love that role-playing game. There's just so many things that you can do with vampires. Love Interview with the Vampire
right
also. Yes, let's go. What clan are you? Or are you the GM?
I am not the GM. That would require a far deeper comprehension of rules and the order of things than I am capable of processing. Like, that is not a straightforward system. I'll tell you, the character that I'm most invested in actually is Ministry, which I would have never thought of. But my GM for that game is very, very visionary. And I really appreciate when people can get outside of the stereotypical, like, oh, your character is like this, so they must be like that kind of prescriptive ways to play. And instead looks at, like, what are the sort of powers that you think it would be fun to have? And how can we build something that will enable you, the player, to do the powers you want while also having the kind of gameplay that you want? And so then rather than trying to shoehorn me into either Bruja or Toreador, which I think a lesser DM might have, they were like, she's like, I think you can totally do Ministry. And I'm like, the snake cult people? And she's like, that's just at the beginning. That's just the beginning. So
I never played with that. I actually didn't know what Ministry was.
That's like the renamed.
Yeah,
like,
she's less deep.
Yeah, that's Vampire the Masquerade's attempt to have a less Orientalist version of the group formerly known as the Snake Cult people. So
okay,
Do you play Vampire?
I'm glad they're correcting course.
Indeed,
I haven't in a long time. Honestly, I haven't been part of any regular tabletop games since I was a teenager. It's such a big time commitment.
It is.
I just like play Magic the Gathering now. Which is it's fun and good, you know. Me and my partner do it after we drink coffee in the morning, and
that's so sweet.
We're trying to get together a little masked game night soon, which will be fun.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's
like
totally
that,
something you can do. Yeah.
Like that it doesn't have to be every week for many hours for a long time. But yeah, love the whole vampire mythos. I'm not deleting all of the source books off of my external hard drive. They're there. Those are my comfort source book PDFs. So they're there if I ever want to get really into it.
But, you know, that kind of gaming has been really good to have during the ongoing pandemic. Like my vampire, I mean, yes, somebody can totally do a masked tabletop RPG game, not even a question, but we do ours on Zoom. And so it's me and like queer people from all over the freaking country. And like, I really appreciate that about it as a sort of social hobby that really transcends physical requirements.
I love that. Yeah, it works very well that way.
But that's so cool. I should ask then, if you are an artist and you play Magic, who's your favorite Magic illustrator?
Oh, just gosh.
Illustrators could be plural.
Not a deep pull, but I do love Rebecca Guay. That's like
yes,
so obvious. But recently I made a deck that I was trying to have as many Rebecca Guay cards as I could, but also make it competitive with like good enough to play against the other decks that I have. So yeah, low key other illustrator names are not jumping to mind.
That's fine, but, though. That's great.
You know, I love to see all the little arts. I love that my friend Sage Coffee did some Secret Lair art recently.
Oh,
because they illustrated
cool.
That like not a wolf, like it was like a Twitter account and then a book, and then it's Magic cards now. So
what is
yeah,
this?
Maybe they're
I'm
my
not
favorite.
Familiar, not familiar with this.
I think the Twitter handle is like @notawolf in all caps. And it's like a joke about like being a businessman who's secretly a wolf.
Oh, that's fun. I will check this out. Thank you for the suggestion.
Laird, but it's not deep.
I see this now. Wow. Oh my gosh. Is there anything that I haven't asked you yet that I really should have?
I don't think so. This has been such a great discussion. I've really gotten to talk about all the things that are consuming my time and my mind from day to day right now. And
oh, good.
Yeah, really hope people come and buy some comics at FlameCon. It mm-hmm. is the last in-person show that I am doing this year. And then just sit tight. And be ready to buy Queer and How We Got Here when it comes out.
It sounds so fabulous. So tell our listeners, where can they find you at FlameCon?
Thank you. They can find me at table I-96. I will be tabling with my friend Chris Russo, who does really great, very dirty, gay, furry comics. So I bet some of those will be like under a little adult only kind of divider. But yeah, looking forward to sharing the table with him and seeing folks there.
Oh, that'll be amazing. And I have a panel on Saturday called Queer Eye on the Straight Geek Canon.
Ooh.
Here's my panel description. We are a diverse group of queer nerds, but so many of the stories we love were made by and for cishet white men our father's age or older. What is it about these stories from before our time that weren't created with us in mind that still speak to us today? How do we wrestle with language or even concepts that don't share our politics or comprehend our identities? What beyond simple nostalgia do narratives like classic Star Wars, pro wrestling, or Silver Age comics resonate with us? And why might other queers like you enjoy them too? And this panel is going to be at Saturday of FlameCon, 2:15 p.m., Room D. And my illustrious guests are Josephine Reisman, New York Times bestselling Hugo-nominated authoress of True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, and Ringmaster Vince McMahon and The Unmaking of America. Kaya Toon Klein, who is a fan and physicist out of Australia, who's been on our podcast to talk about X-Men. And I believe they'll be talking actually more about Lord of the Rings in this conversation. And then somebody who I know all of our podcast guests have heard a few times is my resident Star Wars expert, Holly Raymond, PhD. She's a professor of literature and trans studies. Yeah, I do hope everybody will join us for that. So you can say hi to me. I'll be the one that looks like me in an Aura and 95 mask. And say hello to Hazel and go give Hazel your money. Just buy the comics, get the zine, which I'm sure you can take contributions for if folks are so inspired.
Yep. Zine's always free, but you can hand me money whenever you want.
And I didn't mention this specifically, but I believe it was even distributed at, I want to say, the Queer March this year.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. I make it available for folks. So my website is newlevant.com. And it's newlevant.com/COVID zine. You actually don't even need to pick it up from me. You can see it on my website. But yeah, I make it available for anybody to print their own copies because I'm just excited to see it out there. So, you know, I know that some mask blocks have printed it and distributed it. Not sure how many syllables that word has. Or
all the
people
syllables.
Put them in their little free libraries. So, yeah, I don't know where all it's been distributed, but I love to see it. I really appreciate that people want to do that because, yeah, I'm just trying to get folks masked up and get them knowing what to do when they have acute COVID to reduce their chances of getting long COVID and hopefully not have as bad of a time.
Yeah. It's important work for the comics community, the queer community. We want to exist in the future, so we got to take care of each other today. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has really been delightful and a pleasure to have you on the podcast. So you've told everybody to get to your website. Is there any other place folks should be checking out your work? Like, is there a socials that you
Also at New Levant on Instagram, you might see some cat pictures, and
at
H New Levant on Twitter, where I retweet a lot of wastewater data, but also my comics.
I love it. And as for me, I am on Blue Sky as my predominant social media blab place with my handle LEVIN. And that is the best place to ask me podcast questions or the show. And I am still sort of on Twitter, but mostly for work at ELANA_Brooklyn. And to our listeners, keep it geeky and take care of yourselves and each other.